This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I have a roundtable discussion. It's on speculation about urbanist trends for the 2020s. And obviously this year was a turning point, so I want to introduce the guest for the roundtable. I have DK. He's a commenter on urbanism on Twitter. He's based in the Pacific Northwest and originally from the Bay Area. And I also have Adam Mayer, an architect. He's an architect from San Francisco. He's already been a previous guest, but it's great having you on. And if either of you want to give like a really brief intro, that's fine.
Sure. Hi, I'm DK on Twitter. I went to present myself as any sort of expert on this topic. I'm basically a Twitter shit poster for the most part. I spent the last almost two decades living in Portland, but have recently moved to the high desert of Central Oregon, and you can guess which town.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I've been on the podcast a few times before, so thank you, Robert, for having me back. Just to refresh everyone's memory, I'm an architect. I'm based in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I was born and raised. I focus on a large scale buildings like skyscrapers and also and kind of overlapping with urban planning a bit. I spent 3 years working in China as well, so I bring a perspective of Asian urbanism back to California.
So yeah, like there's all these events that have been kind of triggered by the pandemic, economic trends, remote work being huge. Yeah, all these trends, a lot of them will be long-lasting for sure. I want to kind of start off with kind of the obvious ones. Yeah, I mean, you see things like yoga bubbles or these like partitions, these like cubes around students and schools. And the thing with these kind of trends is I don't think those specific examples are not going to be permanent after the pandemic's over. I do think they do kind of represent this kind of like overall trend. How we redesign urban spaces during the pandemic, how that will be an issue. And then the other thing is like outdoor dining. Yeah, streets being closed off in a lot of cities and towns, and that could very well be permanent. And a lot of these trends are negative, but that I mean I think that could be like a positive trend, especially taking into account like offsetting a lot of the decline in retail that's going to impact street life.
So having recently visited a number of small towns in both Oregon and California, what I did notice is that the removal of on-street parking and the replacing of it with basically a permanent structure, a wooden patio with a gazebo over top to protect from elements, also portable butane heaters, that's happening pretty much everywhere that I'm seeing. So I wouldn't be surprised if that were a permanent trend, if people just end up being huge fans of that and the spaces never revert back to parking. In my own area, what I see a lot is food cart pods, but they're usually based around a permanent structure. So you'll have like a bar or a pub that is based in kind of like this. It's usually kind of an open air gazebo-like structure, maybe with two walls and two sides of it will be open. and then you'll have a number of food carts around it. And those are like, I guess it's sort of a boutique fast food option that's quite well adapted to this, to the situation that we're currently living in. And I'm seeing those spring up like mushrooms, even in towns that previously didn't have it, like Sandy, Oregon, Oregon City. That used to be a very Portlandia thing, and now I've seen its proliferation.
You know, and just on the point of the changes and trends in dining, especially with regard to outdoor dining, I think this is definitely one of the silver linings of the pandemic. I think it's a great development. In San Francisco, there's what's called the Shared Streets Program, which is basically an expedited permitting process for restaurants, local restaurants, to basically take over, you know, the sidewalk and also perhaps some on-street parking spaces as well. But the interesting thing that I've seen in the Bay Area is that this isn't just happening in San Francisco. This is also happening in the suburbs. So like on the peninsula, you have towns like Redwood City, Palo Alto, Menlo Park that have basically taken a few blocks of their downtown streets, locked them to traffic, and just completely opened them up to restaurants. And this sort of thing, you know, pre-pandemic would have been unheard of because you would have had NIMBYs complaining about, you know, losing parking spaces. You'd have nearby residents, you know, yelling about traffic. So the fact that the pandemic has enabled, you know, towns and cities to kind of adapt quickly is a positive. And it may, you know, in temperate climates like California and also up in Oregon, it makes sense to have more al fresco dining. So this is a trend that I hope continues even after we're through the pandemic.
Yeah, like Third Street Promenade, that was a big success. And in Santa Monica, yeah, it is a silver lining to offset this trend of a decline in retail. So yeah, the pandemic, it created this trend of remote work, and a lot of major tech companies are discussing making this permanent, and it could very well be. There is this discussion of a mass exodus out of urban areas. So DK, you left Portland, and Adam, you're in the Bay Area, and are you noticing this trend of mass exodus based on people you know, or do you think it could be overhyped?
I'm not seeing too many other people that I know do it. I'm pretty much the only person in my department that's taken advantage of permanent work from home by actually leaving the metropolitan area entirely. I was reading an article a little while ago that was showing that there are certain mountain towns like the Truckee, Grass Valley area, Tahoe.
Bozeman, I saw that.
Even Bend. St. George, places like that, where they have percentage of the adult population that works remotely is something like in the 10 to 20% range. So, I think it is certainly a phenomenon in these smaller cities, but I would think for the most part, it's going to be migration from like the dense part of urban areas to the suburbs.
So there's two trends. I guess there's one trend of people leaving these urban areas altogether, or you could see like someone from the central part of LA moving to Orange County, or from the Bay Area to like further inland suburbs. So yeah, you'll probably see both trends. Would you think the suburban trend is more significant?
Probably, yes.
And Adam, would you agree with that based on your observations?
Yeah, I mean, as DK just mentioned, there's a lot of people from San Francisco especially have decamped up to the Truckee, Lake Tahoe region. And I've read some articles recently that the locals up there are not too happy about that, even though that, you know, area relies a lot on tourism, both in the winter and the summertime. I don't think they're happy having all these remote workers coming up there. But I honestly, I think it's just, I don't agree that cities are over. I mean, I remember back in the 2008-2009 recession, I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I remember reading, you know, article after article about how San Francisco's over, the city's done, forget it. And then look what happened after the recession. It came roaring back. I didn't even expect that. The economy came back stronger than ever. So I think there's going to be a point at, you know, once we start getting through the pandemic and kind of get things under control, people are going to want to crave that, you know, city life again. I don't know if it's going to come back to the level that it was, because it was pretty frothy. I mean, there was just so much money going through the San Francisco economy because of the tech and, you know, the startup venture capital world, which has definitely been put on hold. But, you know, I wouldn't write off cities.
And I think it will change things. So people will move somewhere where that they will embrace because of the culture or aesthetic. It could actually improve the culture in a positive sense, because a lot of people, they live in a city and their whole identity is maybe invested into their work. So I think if people move to a city for the cultural or aesthetic reason, I see that as a positive trend.
There are a lot of people already I see that, you know, are excited to have the opportunity to maybe now live in San Francisco, people that were shut out previously because the housing and the rental prices were too high before, and, you know, more kind of in the creative fields. So who knows, maybe there's a silver lining there as well.
I guess I would respond to that in a couple of ways. One is one particular variable that wasn't present during previous periods of urban decay and revival is internet technology that actually made all this remote work possible. Like even 20 years ago, I think it was a bit primitive compared to now. So there is this new variable at play that could make things turn out very differently. And additionally, I basically do agree with Adam that cities aren't over, but I would point out that even places like Bend, Santa Fe, Bozeman, even the Truckee Tahoe area are effectively cities unto themselves. Like they're not massive metropolitan areas in the way that New York or the Bay Area are. I think people will still cluster, but the question is whether they will still cluster quite as densely as before and in conglomerations that are as quite as big as before.
The thing is, like, we've discussed this issue before, like with the whole YIMBY versus NIMBY divide. So the economic boom in the Bay Area could have been a tremendous opportunity if they accommodated more housing. But at this point, like, I think a lot of people are kind of happy that to see, like,
the pressure's off,
remote work is spreading out the distribution.
See, I think right now the most valuable amenity for most people is space. And that could be space in terms of access to parks and national forest, or it could be space in terms of, like, patio, house, backyard, and so forth. So, I mean, I do wonder in the case of, like, New York or Manhattan, if this is actually going to be an opportunity for, say, you know, one person to acquire an entire flat or an entire floor of a building, as opposed to living in a 500 square foot apartment. I don't think it's at that point yet, but you know, if vacancies go up sufficiently high, I do wonder if they'll start combining some of these apartments and just making them bigger.
I could definitely see that happening. I mean, there has been significant drops in rental prices, but the thing is, the cost of single family homes have stayed pretty much steady, or in some cases increasing if they're these suburbs people are fleeing to. But rental prices are seeing a decline. And then besides remote work, yeah, you're also seeing a lot of major companies or corporations are leaving California. So, like, the discussion of, like, Uber leaving SF due to some of the regulations with the pandemic.
Yeah, did you guys see the news about Palantir recently? They're a Palo Alto-based technology company.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard about that.
And they just made news recently because very publicly the founder was, you know, went on a rant against California and the culture here and the taxes, and they're moving to Colorado. I mean, it's obviously the timing matters too, because they're about to IPO, but it's interesting. And there was also the example of, you know, Joe Rogan, the podcast host and comedian. He, you know, signed a deal, I think a month or two ago, with Spotify, $100 million deal, and then he moved to Austin, Texas. So
I do think the tech industry will become more decentralized geographically.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a good thing in the long run. I don't think, you know, I think the Bay Area will remain the hub of technology, but I think spreading it out a bit so there's not so much of a pressure cooker here in the Bay Area is probably a good thing for the Bay Area and for the rest of the country as well.
Sure. I mean, San Francisco and the Bay Area are not going to go away, but there is a possibility that their population could decline by 10%. And yeah, maybe that would actually be beneficial to those who remain.
It's obviously not going to be like Detroit after with the decline in like the auto industry and these like Rust Belt cities, I mean, that's pretty ridiculous that people are saying that. Could, yeah, you're saying there could be like a decline by like population by 10%.
Or even 5%.
Yeah, I don't really see like a major decline. I think in some ways like the quality of life could actually improve if there's less stress for people having to be concentrated there for work. It does seem like there's been this massive decline in retail, and even prior to the pandemic, that was happening with like online shopping and Amazon, but the pandemic has exacerbated that. Yeah, I do think that could be a really negative trend for urbanism, because you do need a degree of like retail, restaurants too, but non-restaurant retail contributes to that, like to have like walkable urbanism. So I do think we're already seeing this trend, and I will probably see more of it, of more vacant storefronts and areas that did have like a lot of foot traffic, like seeing a major decline.
This was already a major trend that I was seeing prior to the pandemic, and the pandemic has just exponentially made this even more, a quicker decline for the retail industry. And, you know, mom and pop businesses are suffering really hard everywhere. Meanwhile, Amazon stock is through the roof, and some other, you know, online technology companies like Etsy and Wayfair, Shopify have done really well during the pandemic. But prior to the pandemic, I noticed the retail was going more away from goods, like selling actual physical goods, to more service-oriented stuff. So in San Francisco, for instance, there were, you know, more obviously bars and restaurants, but also boutique gyms and beauty salons and these sort of things. Unfortunately, those have been, you know, hit pretty badly by the pandemic lockdowns.
I do think with remote work, like there's going to be all this vacant office space. And I think actually like in New York and downtown San Francisco, downtown LA probably as well, I think converting that to residential could be beneficial to urbanism, because office workers, they leave after like 5 p.m., but they could become much more vibrant if you convert the office space to apartments and condos.
The big problem with that, Robert, is that cities, at least in California, derive so much tax revenue from both retail and commercial office.
Is this because of Prop 13?
Yeah, Prop 13 is a big part of it. They're not incentivized to build new housing because they don't really see much benefit financially for that. So, I mean, cities and towns are going to have a financial reckoning of sorts, and I'm not sure what that's going to look like, but it's probably not going to be pretty.
Adam, on past shows, like we've discussed this concept of interior urbanism, or a, kind of like a self-contained city, like the architect John C. Portman. But what's notable about his work is a lot of these projects, like the Embarcadero Center in San Francisco, Buenaventura Hotel in downtown LA, and the big hotel, I forget if it's Marriott or Hyatt, but the one in Times Square in New York. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of these projects were in reaction to the urban decay and crime of the 70s, and now it seems like we are kind of entering another era of that kind of a urban decay. But the thing is a lot of urbanists do have this obsession, and street level is important, but this kind of silly obsession that everything has to be at street level. But it would be interesting to see, like, in major urban areas like Manhattan, where if there is like, say, rising crime levels, but they don't want to abandon the city completely, like, they could incorporate more of these elements of interior urbanism. Like, I think sky bridges, which are, they're fairly popular in Asian cities.
I mean, Asian cities have the density. For instance, Hong Kong has a lot of sky bridges, and, you know, they have the density of people to have that. I mean, you mentioned the Embarcadero Center in San Francisco, and it's really sad because that whole area, the financial district, downtown San Francisco, Union Square, is a complete ghost town. So the local businesses there that mainly serve the, you know, the
Are you talking about because
workers.
Of the pandemic or even prior to the pandemic?
No, because of the pandemic.
Well, so, even prior, I visited the Embarcadero Center a couple of months prior, and I didn't get the impression that it was a particularly hopping place.
I visited there about 2 years ago. It is a sort of hidden gem in that sense, but I think a lot of people flat out just don't know about it. So most of the people you see there, they're patrons of the hotel or they're office workers. There's the office component of the Embarcadero Center, and then there's also the shopping mall, which has these different layers, and including Skybridge's, and the last time I went there, it felt fairly deserted.
Yeah, I don't see, unfortunately, Robert, I don't see American cities going the way of, you know, skyscrapers and skybridges and really cool futuristic looking, you know, cities like you're seeing in China right now. I see more what Decay was mentioning about, you know, people moving to, you know, like second tier cities that are more affordable, that kind of more, you know, have a more local feeling, maybe
like
a more semi-rural feeling.
Kind of mid-rise mixed-use developments. We'll continue to see that, but
exactly
with this kind of like new suburban exodus, yeah, I mean, it is kind of important to kind of learn from the mistakes in the past. Like, I was kind of following one of the Yimby Twitter accounts, and they're mentioning, like, in the city of Tracy, and it's in the Central Valley, kind of adjacent to the Bay Area, like, they're approving, like, a whole new, like, track housing type development, which probably is catering to a lot of these remote workers. So we did have this mass exodus to the suburbs through basically the second half of the 20th century, from like the 50s to the 90s. And I think it is important to kind of learn from the mistakes of the past and how we build suburbs. I mean, I think it is inevitable that people are going to keep moving out there, and you can't, that trend isn't going to stop. But yeah, I mean, rethinking a lot of the mistakes. And one thing is, there is the kind of a typical suburban layout is pretty banal, and a lot of that has to do with the kind of with zoning. So you might have like just one street line with like one story businesses. Some cases it's just like parking lots and then residential on the side. It does seem there is this positive trend now of like kind of like small town urbanism or retrofitting suburbia, where the suburbs are kind of a fusion of suburbs, small towns, and cities. Well, some, I mean, some suburbs and small towns included, they do feel like you drive around and there's like very little foot traffic, and there's just a lack of amenities.
There's I see a lot of a hybrid model here in the Pacific Northwest. A little of both. So, for example, I was recently in Truckee as well as Ashland. And both of those towns were building like a full block mixed use development in their downtown areas. And they were, look like they're going to be four stories tall and using sort of the rustic industrial aesthetic. And four stories is probably appropriate for towns like that. I mean, I could see people living there, you know, not wanting anything overly massive and hulking around them. But like the suburbs of Seattle and Portland, have developed a lot of urban features, particularly like Bellevue, Kirkland, Redmond, Bothell, Vancouver, Washington, just north of Portland, where they do have downtowns with mixed use, mid-rise buildings with condos and apartments. And they still do have strip malls, but they also have these sort of designated, dense, walkable urbanism work-play areas. So I think there is a move away from just that strict, separation of uses model that we saw in the 70s, at least here in the Pacific Northwest. I know that's, maybe it's not as prevalent in LA, although I know there are some towns in LA or some suburbs in LA where it's a thing.
But the thing is, with this like new urban exodus, like you have this urban hipster demographic moving to the suburbs, and they're importing like a different culture to the suburbs and to small towns that that wasn't really existing to that degree before. And I think, as you were kind of saying, like in a place like Truckee, I'm sure a lot of the old timers there probably have like some degree of resentment. I mean, that is going to bring about a kind of significant cultural change. Like, there's this one kind of concept that Decay and I have like discussed over on Twitter. It's called like ski lodge urbanism. I think what the appeal is that it does have like a rustic charm of a traditional small town, but it also would have more urban amenities. These more ski lodge resorts, some of them in Tahoe, places like Vail, Aspen have them. So DK, are you talking about this, when you think about ski lodge urbanism, you're thinking primarily hypothetically, or are you talking about actual the place, some of these towns you visited that they're propping up in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, such towns do exist, but the model is not that pervasive among small towns. Like, you see it most frequently in, like, the ski towns of the Rockies in Colorado, where you'll actually have these five-story condominiums and hotels, and you'll have, like, kind of a dense walkable downtown. But, you know, the footprint of the city will be fairly small. Like, there's not a lot of area to cover in terms of, you know, driving by a car, so you can get around by bike or by cross-country skis, whatever the season happens to be. And so the whole point of this is that you don't necessarily have to have a ski resort to have this model of urban planning. Like, there are, I think it probably does help if a small town does have a lot of outdoor recreation activities nearby to actually make it an appealing place. But yeah, the whole idea is you basically import these features to other small towns that are not based entirely around skiing. So you have a downtown with some, like, you know, rustic looking hotels and condominiums with multiple stories, and then you have storefronts on the bottom, and you have some you swap out the traffic lights with roundabouts, and you make it more aesthetically pleasing and walkable. Yeah, like, why not do that in places other than just Vail and Aspen?
I think the problem is that a lot of American small towns are kind of based on that model of sprawl, just based on how the Western United States were settled, and then later,
sure,
way much later with the automobile. And but there just are these kind of, a lot of these kind of out of the box solutions. You can look to for inspiration. So the more futuristic model would be Asian cities with all the sky bridges. But I agree with Adam that that I actually don't see that really catching on, unfortunately. But also, like, there's things to learn about urbanism from universities, resorts, and, like, more kind of the more traditional European small towns, which are obviously more compact, and zoning's obviously a barrier. The thing is, like, you get all these, like, well-off people from the west side of LA or other suburban areas, and they travel to Europe, and they talk about how great everything is. But then when they come home, like, they don't really, like, make the connection of how their own communities could become, like, more like that.
Right, correct. So, yeah, I think there's an opportunity for more small towns to look kind of like a village in the Alps of Switzerland. I don't think the Tahoe region has really taken advantage of that. When I was in Tahoe recently,
well, the thing is, like, they can't sprawl because of the national parks there. I mean, that would be a travesty if that were to happen. But
a lot of cabin sprawl.
Oh yeah, like, but in the more kind of compact spaces, they can have, like, a ski lodge urbanism.
Right.
Tahoe just doesn't have a lot of space to build out. Truckee has a little bit more, but I'm actually surprised more people haven't opted for Reno, because they have a lot more space. And also, when you get over to the Nevada side of the border, you don't have to deal with California taxes. So,
right, Reno is booming. I passed through there.
Yes.
Not my preferred aesthetic, but
no.
It's growing fast.
Yeah, Vegas never really took off. Like, a lot of people from LA were moving to Vegas, but they tended to be people who were lower income, who could sell their home in a lower income community for, like, $300,000 and buy something more kind of like suburban. But Vegas never really attracted, like, large numbers of upper middle class professionals. But I think Reno could.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, you mentioned Vegas, and even though that's one of the sprawliest cities in the West, that's probably the only city that I could think of that would implement your Asian interior urbanism model on any level.
Well, yeah,
level.
It basically already is. Like, the strip is interior urbanism. Like, you can literally, like, walk several blocks past different casinos and basically be entirely, like, indoors. But it's basically a theme park. Which is a different, like, there's much more flexibility and creativity in theme parks, but yeah, Vegas is, like, peak interior urbanism.
Yeah, the strip. But you remember, maybe it was a little over a decade ago, I guess his name's Tony Shea, he was the founder of the online shoe company called Zappos, which ended up getting acquired by Amazon. He moved. He started in San Francisco, but when his company grew to a certain point, he moved everything to Las Vegas.
I think it was specifically downtown Vegas.
He kind of went on this mission to try and revitalize downtown Las Vegas.
Well, they do have a kind of mini hipster district. Right. It's called Fremont East, if you've ever been there.
Yeah, I mean, I actually really like downtown Vegas, and I've been to the Fremont East area, and I think it's pretty cool. There's some cool bars and restaurants around there. But, you know, if you are in Vegas, you know, single-family homes are so affordable that I don't think there's really so much incentive for people to want to, you know, live in a Manhattan-style setting.
If they do build those kind of developments, like, they're economically less, like, they're for the experience, but they're economically less efficient than buying a single family home, because it will be like $1 million condo for the same size in a single family home. It will be like $300,000, so it's not really cost efficient. It's more for like the experience for those who can afford it. With the whole kind of like YIMBY versus NIMBY divide, like YIMBYs who want to build more housing, do you think that they sometimes push too far when they say things like abolish all single family zoning because there's that view, or do you think they should take a more pragmatic, like, middle ground?
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the YIMBY cause for sure, especially in the Bay Area and California more generally. You know, we need to do a better job of building housing. But when you say things like, you know, abolish single family zoning, or, you know, let's just build, who cares about architecture or aesthetics, we just need to add units, I don't think that's the correct framing of the debate, especially for people who are resistant to it. Instead of talking about just density and pure units of housing, I think it'd be better if YIMBYs perhaps, you know, argued for more kind of, like, you know, gentle density or more gentle infill. Like, I'm actually reading a really great book right now by an architect, Daniel Paralek. It's called The Missing Middle, and it's really about, you know, introducing more like duplex to fourplex, you know, courtyard apartments and these sort of things. You actually see, you know, a good number of examples of these throughout the LA area, mostly pre-World War II.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I grew up as a kid in the 90s in one of those, like, duplexes that was built in the 1920s. And that was actually one that got torn down more recently for newer apartments, but missing middle, like, apartments, like duplexes, row houses. And also think, like, focusing...
Townhouses, yeah.
Yeah, townhouses, like really putting the energy. I think commercial corridors, like, you're still going to have opposition from NIMBYs, but it will not be to the same degree as, like, upzoning a single-family home neighborhood. But the thing is, like, right now in, like, the election, it has been brought up, and it's... you have conservatives saying that it's part of a communist conspiracy, and then Trump responding, and then, like, Democrats... or the left, point, like, using that as an example to point out how conservatives are racist. So it's kind of a shame how it's been become a sort of polarized, like, culture war issue instead of actually having a constructive discussion of how we can use reform zoning to actually build more aesthetically pleasing and livable communities.
I agree. One issue that I take with YIMBYism is they seem to ignore the fact that when one makes a decision regarding where to live, whether it's, even if it's renting, but particularly if it's buying, you're buying into the general atmosphere that surrounds your domicile. Like eventually you have to leave the house. And so what people experience when they go outside and walk around, that factors heavily into the decision that they make. And so, like, I think people actually do want, like, a certain amount of, security or control over the built environment that surrounds where they happen to live. And I think if you went so far as to abolish single family housing entirely, it might just lead to the development of a greater number of HOAs, which have codes that are far more restrictive than city zoning ordinances.
Those do exist. Basically, where a neighborhood functions the way, like, a private gated community does. So those HOAs they're actually immune from, like, they would be immune from, like, that zoning bill that Scott Wiener was proposing that got voted down.
Right. I mean, personally, I'd rather just, I guess I'm in favor of zoning, and I would rather have, like, certain areas that are designated for high density, mid rise, or even high rise housing with mixed use on the ground floor. You have certain areas for that, and you have other areas for a more low density arrangement. There are a lot of people who have a fairly negative psychological reaction to being around crowds, being around too many people. And I don't think that's really taken seriously. So, I mean, I do think like more units should be built. I think there's plenty of good space for that. Like, I don't think you need to be building a skyscraper in a single family home area. I do think ADUs are pretty promising because in that case, you're actually giving homeowners some sort of incentive to increase density. Like, it's an extra source of income. And then the way the structure, the aesthetics of the structure more or less fit in with that environment. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I agree pretty much with all that. I don't think zoning is inherently evil or bad, but you know, when it's either, you know, all you have is single family or like commercial strip malls, that's not balanced. But I think we can get to a more balanced zoning in, you know, cities and also smaller towns and suburbs without, you know, quote unquote, abolishing single family homes. But I also think the argument for adding more units of housing would be more palatable if, you know, they were more aesthetically pleasing. So back to the conversation about missing right. middle housing and also about kind of ski lodge urbanism. When you build new buildings that are more contextual to, you know, the style and culture of where you're building, I think people will accept it more easily. For instance, like, you know, Robert, in LA, a lot of the beautiful, you know, courtyard apartment buildings and, you know, fourplex and duplex buildings in LA are kind of in this like Mediterranean Spanish style.
Grew up in an area like in the 90s of the Westwood area, which had a lot of those types of like Spanish duplexes and courtyard apartments. And they were replaced by these big kind of concrete boxes.
Like homogenous boxes.
Yeah, mostly in the 90s. And I think a lot of like old timers will say, because that structure is unaesthetically pleasing, that they'll have a kind of knee-jerk reaction against density. So yeah, having like a medium density and a missing middle, that is aesthetically pleasing. The thing is, like, it does seem like it would be harder to kind of legislate that than other zoning, because the thing is, aesthetics are subjective.
Yeah, and also, yeah, and you know, developers too, they want to maximize their return. So, you know, architects were kind of, you know, our hands are tied in some ways. You know, for instance, I think one of the things about the pandemic that is driving more design, a design trend that I see more is, you know, people wanting more outdoor space. But developers, especially in a lot of these new condo buildings that have gone up over the past decade, kind of want to minimize the amount of outdoor space because they can't charge square footage for that. So, you know, the developers' finances and the return they want to get is oftentimes at odds with architecture.
Another big trend right now with urbanism is like the dead malls. And this was already an issue with online shopping, like with retail. But I think the pandemic has been the final nail in the coffin for malls. And a lot of them are being renovated and repurposed. And I'm not opposed to that. I think that's a good thing if they respect the aesthetic. But the thing is, like, I think the main thing is like a lot of them are being transformed into tech campuses. So, Horton Plaza in San Diego and Westside Pavilion in West LA, they were actually, I mean, they were both originally designed by the same architect back in the 80s, John Jarday. Westside Pavilion was completely destroyed, and with Horton Plaza, they are keeping some aspects of the original, but a lot of these types of developments are just incredibly, they're bland and minimalistic.
Oh, yeah, I mean, one other thing, too, is, you know, with COVID now, I don't even know if these tech companies are going to need the office space. But what, one thing I read recently is that Amazon is looking at dead malls and perhaps turning them into logistics centers.
Or yeah. would that be like a logistics center, or is that a fulfillment center where customers come and pick up packages?
Could be both.
And the question is whether that's enough to create like sufficient foot traffic to keep all the smaller shops within the mall alive. I don't know. I mean, I think it's just as likely that that a lot of these malls will be demolished and replaced with something entirely different than to actually be retrofitted. It'll probably be a little bit of both.
That's what happened with Horton Plaza in San Diego. Is their most recent rendering is an improvement over the original. So like I'll post a link to it so the audience can see what it looks like. But it was just all these kind of bright pastel colors and then these geometrical shapes. And they are keeping the sort of the geometrical pattern where one building goes into another. But the color palette, there just has been this kind of trend that really took off in the 2010s where, even with the shopping malls, Westfield renovated a bunch of shopping malls around 2010, and they basically made them all, look like tech campuses.
I was just going to say, yeah, I think they'll do that unless there's some sort of code that indicates that they have to build in according to a particular design. I did want to just briefly go back to a point that you made earlier about the design or form-based codes. The entire western half of Bend, where I live, I'll just dox myself because why not, basically has that. Like pretty much every building looks like some sort of variation of a log cabin or an industrial building. Even the Safeway looks like a log cabin. And I know Santa Fe is another good example where every building has to have this Spanish colonial theme with stucco and so forth. So I think it's possible, but I don't know that most towns are incentivized to do this.
What is interesting to kind of speculate, aesthetic trends, architectural trends. So we went modernism to postmodernism back to a form of modernism. Yeah, the kind of minimalist aesthetic that really took off in the 2010s. Yeah, I mean, it really did was popular, especially with Silicon Valley. And I think it's different because, I do like a lot of modernism, more the earlier wave of modernism. So a good example of that is the architect, I think, a Japanese name, I think he did the original World Trade Center.
Oh,
and a lot of Yamasaki. He also designed a lot of the hotels in Century City in LA. His work is modernism and it's fantastic. So I appreciate the modernism from that era.
Yeah, actually, Yamasaki designed the Century Plaza Towers,
the
triangular twin towers in Century City. And I actually,
one of my
first jobs after architecture school was working on a renovation of the lobby spaces there. So that was a fun project, especially, to work on this very classic mid-century modernist office tower. Yeah, I agree with you, Robert. I like that.
He also did, I think he may have done the Century Plaza Hotel.
I'll have to
recheck that. But then there used to actually be an underground mall connecting the two parts that was built. That was very 70s. And then it just wasn't getting enough foot traffic. So I think it's like a Hollywood agency now, and it's like a big kind of glass, cube with an empty space in between.
Oh, I think that you're talking about the Creative Artists
Agency. Oh, that's
agency,
right. That's
the CAA
right.
Office building. But, I think maybe we will be seeing more of a trend away from minimalism, modernism to kind of more vernacular and traditional local architecture. Actually, I read a very interesting piece in The Atlantic just a few days ago by this architectural writer, Darren Anderson. It's called Why Every City Feels the Same Now, and Glass and Steel Monoliths Replace Local Architecture, It's Not Too Late to Go Back. So I thought that was interesting. I think, we'll still build buildings with modern technologies, modern HVAC, the best insulation products and doors and windows, and, kind of design more with, sustainability and green building strategies in mind. But aesthetically, perhaps we shift more toward a regionalism or a local aesthetic, is my prediction.
I mean, I have seen proposals for some newer skyscrapers or high-rises in LA, and some of them seem to be, there was pure minimalism of the 2010s, and some of them are kind of going back a bit to postmodernism, or maybe some kind of hybrid of modernism and postmodernism. So a little bit of a different trend that's different than what we were seeing a decade ago. Those were proposed when the economy was better. The reality is we could very well see a major economic decline this decade, and a lot of more kind of extravagant, grandiose architecture will get constructed and proposed when there's an economic boom. The question is, will there be an aesthetic of austerity for the 2020s?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. To me, right now, it's difficult to predict how at least the American economy is going to recover or not from 2020. It's been a tough year.
Yeah, I wouldn't have predicted anything that happened this year prior to this year. So it's very difficult for me to render an accurate prediction in this regard. I mean,
yeah, we probably will see a lot less skyscrapers proposed, but we will see a lot of the trends as far as like the missing middle and that model being used to retrofit suburbia. Like those will be the trends, but not so much. We're probably
like the mega structures.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
Big developments like Hudson Yards in Manhattan and that
no,
sort
we
of
won't
thing.
See
I don't
that
think.
For probably right. For quite some time, for possibly another decade. But there's a kind of thing like in fast food, like kind of industrial chic. It depends how it's done.
I think it taps a little bit into nostalgia. So like pretty much everything in my neighborhood looks like it was built in the 1800s, even though it was built in the last 5 years. And it has, as Robert was saying, on the interior, it's fully outfitted with modern utilities. Good example of a building that's going up pretty close to me is it's a public market space where it uses, it's using that industrial aesthetic, even though it's not a retrofitted industrial building. It's a brand new building, but it's made to look industrial. And so I think it'll have something like 10 to 15 food stalls, you know, with like an outdoor plaza, I think like a small grocery store. Okay, if I were to make a prediction, I would say that I think that these these public market clusters with a large outdoor seating area, usually centered around a bar, and using this industrial aesthetic, I wouldn't be surprised if that proliferated because that seems to be adapted to present conditions.
Yeah, in some cases, like some of them, like they do retrofit old warehouses, but sometimes they'll build it. They'll build it from scratch to look like a retrofitted like old warehouse.
Yep.
Yeah, like with really high ceilings and then
exposed beams
exposed
on the front.
Beams, yeah.
You have a big timber beam with some like large metal rivets and huge bolts into it. You know, it looks like it served some sort of vital industrial function in the past, but it's there
That's
for aesthetic purposes.
That's very quintessentially Pacific Northwest. I love it though. I love that.
I do. I'm a big fan. I'm not knocking it.
Right now, we have these natural disasters like the fires in California, and we could kind of speculate to the degree that they're caused by climate change, but it does seem to be getting worse than in the past, and like how to build communities taking into account these risks. So sprawl is a huge problem, just because like lots of dry foliage is obviously an issue, but if homes are spread out, it does make it more difficult for the firefighters to get in there. But on the other hand, some people do have anxiety about living in apartments in denser situations because, like, they're in West LA, like, there was a high-rise apartment tower that caught fire, and it is the idea that, like, one person's actions in one building could destroy everything, and some people might find more security in a single-family home. All of these models would have some concerns about fire risk. But has there really been a lot of like a serious look into like how to build cities taking this into account?
The past week here in the Bay Area with the Northern California fires has been apocalyptic. I mean, today was the first day I was able to go out and go for a run, and in over a week the smoke has been so bad. And this kind of hits close to home too, because my uncle lives in a community called Bonnie Doon, which is just north of Santa Cruz, and he had to evacuate, and luckily his house survived, but many of his neighbors weren't as lucky. So, I mean, the question about do we need to rethink the patterns of development, I mean, knowing the kind of people that live, for instance, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which are the coastal mountains here in the Bay Area and to the south, the people that live in these communities really love their mountain lifestyle, and I don't even think that a fire like of the magnitude that we just saw is going to deter them from, you know, wanting to live that lifestyle. So I mean, the great thing about California and the great thing about America in general is I think that we offer so many different, you know, lifestyle choices when it comes to, you know, where you want to live, whether it's rural, suburban, or, you know, a very urban experience. So I hope we can see, you know, a nice balance and a mix going forward.
Yeah. My aunt and uncle lost their home a couple of years ago. I think it was the car fire, the one in Sonoma. And they've already rebuilt it in the same location. And I think they're just banking on, well, you know, this area is burned. It burnt to the ground last year, so it'll probably be another 30 years before it happens again.
I was in Southern California when the fire did come pretty close to where I was. We did have to kind of end up evacuating. So it does really seem it's these areas that are more kind of these semi-rural areas, like up in the hills, the more generic suburban areas that have some degree of distance from wilderness just are probably like somewhat safe. How much of a risk do you think there is for fires and higher density?
Like towers or just like...
Or even like a kind of missing middle, like
suburbs.
Say, like just living in like a five-story, a four-story apartment or condo complex.
I mean, fire codes in California are pretty stringent. So in California in 2020, I'd feel safer living in a new high-rise in downtown San Francisco than, you know, somewhere surrounded by woods. Just because these new modern buildings in the urban areas are, you know, fitted out with, you know, fire sprinklers and fire exits and all sorts of, you know, systems to prevent a catastrophe.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything about either of you would like to add about trends as far as aesthetics or how urban trends relate to the pandemic and economic situation?
Sure. I don't think there's going to be any revival in the use of public transit in this country. That's a particular mode of conveyance.
They're going to open up soon the Metro extension to Beverly Hills, which, funny enough, Adam was telling me that Kamala Harris's husband was involved in the lawsuit to block that.
Yeah, he was. I think he was arguing on behalf of the city of Beverly Hills or the Beverly Hills School District to try to prevent the Purple Line, you know, the underground, from going through their community. I thought that was...
Well, yeah, the Purple Line is going to open up in Beverly Hills pretty soon, the next couple of years.
Oh, that's great for LA. I mean, it's been a long time coming.
The question is to what degree it will be used. I know the Metro extension to Bellevue from Seattle, I think they recently finished digging that too. So these lines are still under construction, but the question is... are people, I don't know, with remote work, are you going to have a sufficient number of professionals writing these systems to keep them afloat? And will people be more likely to switch to bicycles, electric bicycles, and so forth in the case where they need to commute through a congested area? Will public transit have the ridership to keep their lines running?
Yeah, I think self-driving cars could take off maybe in like a decade.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Decay's point. I mean, the two major transit systems here in the Bay Area, BART, and then also, you know, Caltrain, which runs up and down the peninsula, their ridership numbers have gone way down during the COVID pandemic, and I don't really know financially how they're going to survive. They're probably going to need a bailout. And I've also, you know, I'm a big transit rider and enthusiast, and as are many of my friends, and even a lot of these folks are finally, you know, buying a car, which, you know, would have been unheard of last year, but unfortunately that's probably the way it's going to go for a while.
So kind of the people who say like urbanism is over, and you have the kind of like hardcore urbanists like Richard Florida disputing that, but I think what we've learned from this discussion is that based on trends, it will probably be some combination of both, as trends usually are. It won't be the complete end of cities. I think, yeah, like the trends that we'll see is more of the missing middle and more medium to smaller cities getting building up.
Totally agree.
And yep. Before I wrap up, Adam, do you want to plug the new blog? It's an architectural blog that you're working on.
Oh, you know, actually, I'm working on opening up my own practice right now. So I'll let you know when that's going to happen. But actually, interestingly enough, it's going to focus more on this missing middle type of gentle infill. So I'm excited to start getting going on that, and I'll let you know when that's up and ready to go. But it's in the works right now.
Adam Mayer and DK, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me.